Wow. Ronnie Jackson, congressman from Texas, so disgusted by Rihanna's performance last night at halftime that he suggested Ted Nugent. We are playing, is it Teddy or Riri? That Nadine, what a teenage queen. She looking so clean, especially down in between. What I like. Wang dang, sweet poontang. Wang dang, sweet poontang.
Oh my God. I'm pretty sure Riri has never uttered the name Nadine, so I'm going to go with Teddy.
You're right. That is a classic Ted Nugent song. You know, they just don't write lyrics like Wang Dang Sweet Poontang anymore, and it just is, it's underappreciated. Such a shame.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
And welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today during your lunch hour, the noon hour. Coming up at 12:30, we are going to be talking to Wisconsin Watch reporter Mario Caron, who has spent the better part of the last year investigating different stories in Keel, Wisconsin. And I think my first question for him is there anyone who knows more about Keel that doesn't live in Keel, Wisconsin than you?
And you?
But I have a special connection to that story because it is one of my proudest moments so far when Rick Essenberg of Will wrote an op-ed in response to my TikTok.
That is the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty for anyone who's unclear.
Thank you. So we're going to talk to him, so I'm really looking forward to that. But our guest this first half hour is a returning champion. She was with us back in before the midterms, and we had invited her on then because of so many political advertisements that were talking about cash bail. And I had thought there was a lot of not a clear understanding of the general public of what cash bail is, why it is there, and how it was being used as a scare tactic. And now fast forward to this next election cycle, and there is going to be a cash bail amendment on your ballot April 4th. And so we thought we would have Ms. Jessa Nicholson, criminal defense lawyer, back to talk about not only reiterate what cash bail is, what its intended use is, and what other options might be if the real concern is not letting repeat offenders and violent people out on the street while they are waiting for trial. So welcome back, Jessa Nicholson.
Thank you. I'd kind of like to talk about how I used to babysit for Ted Nugent, but I think that was prior. So, but that's real. That is a real story I could tell you at a later date and time.
Wow. I can't wait.
That's a whole segment in and of itself, Jessa.
If we run out of questions to ask about cash bail before the end of this half hour, we're coming back to that.
We can circle back to Fred Bear. So, yes, cash bail, it's back, this time in the form of a constitutional amendment, which I have no doubt will read on the ballot like, crime, don't you hate it? Check yes. Which will provide the public with no actual sense of what that's going to do or protect the public at all. But we're going to phrase it in a really scary way, and we're going to flash signs about the Waukesha County parade homicides, and that's going to generate a lot of voter turnout for this amendment that is a terrible idea.
And so, just to back up a little bit. So, first of all, I just wanted to get clarity on this, because I know at the end of January, beginning of February, there was a lawsuit to try to block this from happening because of like the timing and stuff. Is that gone anywhere? Do you know?
So, and I have to be honest, I haven't looked up exactly where that is. My recollection when I was reading about it is very similar to what happened with the proposed, which is now enacted, Marcy's Law legislation, which is there was a challenge of some type to the way they were going to phrase this on the ballot. And I think we're moving forward with the ballot phrasing as is in April. I assume there's going to be an after-the-fact challenge to it. The challenge to the Marcy's Law ballot phrasing, I think, is still live up in the higher courts here.
And that was 2020, because I remember learning about that right when I got back, and it started As Goes Wisconsin as far. So that's not even – that referenda is not even active yet.
We're still waiting for – the Supreme Court of Wisconsin to chime in and tell us what what our privacy rights under Marcy's Law mean, since that is a place where we've constitutionalized the right to privacy, but didn't define it. So that'll be fun for the future. We're just changing constitutions left and right here in Wisconsin with no real understanding of what that means.
And
so
yes.
let me start there, which okay. is people should know that constitutions, well designed to be living, breathing documents, or at least the liberal judicial philosophy is that they're supposed to be liberal, living, breathing documents that are available to change with the times and be amended to reflect community norms. What is true is you don't usually see multiple changes to a constitution. Those tend to be pretty settled pieces of law where the act of amending a constitution is somewhat extraordinary. And if you look at it, I mean, when's the last time the United States Constitution has been amended?
We were just talking about that.
This isn't something that we see all that often. And so twice just in, you know, this decade, we're seeing Wisconsin voters being asked to, in one sentence descriptors, decide how we're going to fundamentally alter people's constitutional rights in this state. And to clarify, everybody still has federal constitutional rights. So you still have a federal constitutional right to reasonable bail, and you'd still have a Wisconsin constitutional right to reasonable bail, even if this passed. The difference is this would explicitly allow judges to consider, how they're phrasing it, a defendant's public safety risk, quote unquote. And really what that means, what that stand-in for is, we can consider if you're charged with violent crimes or not. Now, you haven't been convicted of this violent crime, which, you know, part of the issue with bail is that it goes hand in hand with that presumption of innocence, that pesky thing that we start with in the criminal justice system, where we decide that people shouldn't be incarcerated without due process. This is, and I've seen the quotes, you know, from some of the sponsoring legislators, this is being spun as, oh, we're just looking to hold violent offenders accountable. Okay, well, that is absolutely a misdirection and misleading. You're not holding violent offenders accountable by setting cash bail. What you're doing is holding people who have the presumption of innocence in custody without due process if they can't afford to post whatever amount is deemed acceptable by whatever judge and whatever re-election scheme they're running for in that moment. And if I sound cynical about this, it's because I feel cynical about it.
You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. We are talking to Jessa Nicholson, who is a defense attorney, talking about cash bail and all of that. Just want to let you guys know the last constitutional amendment was ratified May 7th of 1992.
For the U.S.
The 27th Amendment. Yep.
So the concern here, and I, you know, is, first of all, we are an outlier in this, right? Like, every other state except two or three do have this consideration in their bail process.
So the federal system definitely considers public safety risk, and a number of states do. I don't know if we're only two or three that don't, but a number of states do have provisions for that. The difference here is our bail statute already has the ability to deny certain types of violent offenders cash bail at all pending trial. It's that, number one, the types of offenses are very high level. So it's like homicide, attempted homicide, very serious violent crimes. And the other issue is that in trying to do that and say, we just don't think this person presents as an adequate risk, we think that the risk is too high and they need to be kept pretrial, that would require the state to produce witnesses and perform a hearing where the defendant had the right to cross-examination. It wouldn't be to the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a lower standard for purposes of just getting a court to say, you're right, this guy's too dangerous, let's keep him in. But what this wants to do is what used to be, I mean, what in our current statute is a very narrow set of serious, serious crimes that you only can deny bail if there's been process. What we're saying is we'd like to throw that process away, allow any crime to be considered basically a violent crime for purposes of this, and we'll just set bail higher than we know this defendant can post, but say, no, we've given you the opportunity to post bail. So to me, it's a sleight of hand when what we really want to do is keep people in custody until their trial, and we're pretending that we're still giving them reasonable bail. And we're greatly expanding the people that you can just say by the nature of what they're accused of, with no consideration about their ties to the community or much less consideration about those ties to the community and the other pro-social factors that are, you know, from a social science perspective, actually linked to assuring appearance. We're taking away that process and allowing disproportionately poor people to remain incarcerated pretrial when they've had no process or ability to truth test those accusations.
And that's a lot what we talked about before, as far as this disproportionately affects poor people when they get charged with the crime, because it basically says if I was a dangerous person and I did a dangerous crime, but and there was a very high bail set, as long as I could make it, there's nothing to keep me out, to keep me from getting out, right? So it actually doesn't, as long as there is the money can be paid, it doesn't actually keep that person. If the point is that they are so dangerous, they should not be out in public while they await their trial. If they're rich enough, it doesn't matter. This doesn't help that.
Which is why the statute has this thing for the serious crimes, the serious violent crimes already, because then you can say, well, even if you're Jeffrey Epstein, if you're accused of a crime this violent, this serious, we actually have a procedure to say, because you have enough money to get wherever you'd want to go, we just think you can't have cash. And that, I think, is fine. I want to be clear. You know, people think that the, you know, liberal defense guard is, oh, just let everyone. There are people who present a public safety risk such that pretrial incarceration is necessary. Like, that happens. And our federal system does one of two things. They either release someone with services or they remand you pending trial. And that's based, again, on process, where you have a pretrial services person evaluate and decide if this is a person who really does present those risks. What we're talking about is these initial appearance bail courts that we have in state circuit court. Sometimes that argument is a minute and a half. Most of the time, the person who's a defendant is represented by a public defender that they've never met, will never meet again, and may or may not qualify for, but is just there to be a warm body to do the initial appearances. So it's not as though there's a lawyer going in armed with facts and process and information that they can use to make a good record about their client's life and likelihood to appear.
All right, well, we're going to still be talking to Jessa Nicholson when we come back. She's a private bar criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony defense, and she feels very passionately about this cash bail amendment that you're going to see on your ballot in April. And so we're going to continue the conversation. If you have any questions for her, text them in at 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We got Jane Matinera on the board, and we are talking to Jessa Nicholson, who is a private bar criminal defense attorney who focuses on violent felony defense and has very strong opinions about the cash bail amendment that is going to be on the April 4th ballot that you will get to vote on. But it's not just you, because I was on the list of for the press release for the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, who sent out a press release saying, we oppose this. So in general, from your experience so far, other defense attorneys are also on board saying this is not a good thing.
Yes, and I'm the vice president of the WACDL board currently, and so I know the executive committee was anxious to get that statement out on behalf of the organization. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a criminal defense attorney that thinks that this is going to be good for this system. And, you know, I want to make one point, which is when people are incarcerated pre-trial, they're incarcerated at the county jail. If someone is convicted of a violent felony, odds are good, not always, but odds are good that they're going to prison. So sometimes I hear arguments from people that this isn't really an issue that counties should be concerned about from an economics perspective, because all of that credit counts towards the prison sentence. The thing people are missing there, and I think this is important for conservative people to get, is that the counties pay that cost as part of the jail budget pre-trial. The state of Wisconsin handles the Department of Corrections. So counties that have really liberal bail policies that don't incarcerate the majority of their citizens pre-trial are going to see a huge uptick in the need for jail housing costs in their community. And we don't have a lot of space in many counties to continue to house people in these jails.
And that is, I mean, and you think about, I know everything I've ever heard as far as the entire court system right now is backed up across the state. I mean, certainly I'm sure in Dane County is not so dissimilar from Milwaukee as far as we're in a constitutional crisis when it comes to DAs and public defenders and just people who work on both sides of a case for different criminal charges. And in general, just since COVID, the backlog, and also where do you put people? Because obviously you can't just throw them in a gym and hold them there until their trial. And so
it also, you have to feed them and things too, which gets expensive quickly. I think it's like over $40,000 to feed someone for a year in a local jail.
Yes. And so in your experience, as far as being in the legal world, obviously we just said where the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers stands, but as far as, is there an arm of the legal system that is in favor of this? Like, is this in general prosecutors want this, or in general judges want this?
Conservative Supreme Court candidates appear to be very much in favor of it.
Them.
No, prosecutors tend to say that they're in favor of this. And they say that that's because public safety should be a consideration. And I often hear the argument that judges already consider this as a practical matter. So why does it matter if we amend the language to let them do what they do anyway? And to me, we can ask the same question with, well, people are probably guilty. So why does it matter if we amend the Constitution to take away their right to counsel? Why does it matter? I mean, we already have made an assumption. So why does it matter that we follow the law? I mean, that's just not a persuasive argument to anyone that has a respect for what the system is supposed to stand for and is supposed to do and how it's supposed to work.
And so for you, and like you wave a magic wand, what would be changes, if any, as far as, because there is to a certain extent, there are people who are committing crimes and violent crimes while they're out on bail, right? And so it's like, is there in your magical powers, if you had them, you think something that would address that in a better, more efficient way than amending what we're doing with cash bail?
Yes, I think we should switch to what the federal system does. I think we should have intake workers that when someone is charged with a crime, and maybe we do this only with felonies, but, you know, when someone's charged with a crime, they have an assessment done. We learn about them. We have a hearing where there's actually information presented and a magistrate makes a determination if they can be released with services or if their risk is so high that they are denied release. It's not that I think people should be on bail committing crimes. Yeah. It's that I think that we incarcerate too many people out of fear that there's an outlier like Darrell Brooks when the vast majority of people on bail don't actually offend on bail. And so I think we need some type of system, and I would suggest a social science-based system like the federal system where we collect data and then have a process to determine who actually needs that level of restriction and, you know, that level of segregation from the rest of society and who can function with services like GPS monitoring.
Is there any political will that you've seen to do that?
No.
Okay.
People don't like to be.
Is it harder to do? Is that just like fundamentally harder to do something like that than to do the cash bail thing?
Yeah, it takes way more work. You need people who are actually going to treat defendants as people and not just look at what they're charged with. You need to apply critical thinking and analysis, and you need to have your evidence available early. And a lot of overworked prosecutors' offices don't have time to go through all of those hearings so early.
Yeah.
And so that's a funding issue too. But, you know, instead of pouring all of that money into building new jails, we could adequately fund the rest of the justice system.
Well, Jessa Nicholson, it is always a joy to how passionate you are about this, how eloquently you speak about it and in such plain language. And so so I think we're saying vote no.
We are. And if people are interested, I'm actually debating former AG candidate Eric Toney at the Maple Bluff Country Club on March 16th over the lunch hour on this issue. So, and the media is invited. I don't know why that's allowed, but they're letting me bring people.
We may be on air if it's a lunch thing, but I will definitely tune in to the recording of that because I would love to see you debate Eric Toney.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun, but it's just for information purposes. There
just for information purposes. If you want to send me the information, how people could watch that, I will post it. All right, Jessa, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, have fun with Ted Nugent.
All right. When we come back, talking about Keela, Wisconsin, this is As Goes Wisconsin.
That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Matinair. No matter where you're listening across the Civic Media Network or on the Civic Media app, thank you for tuning in today during your lunch hour. Now, our next guest, I have to admit, so stay with me. I'm going to tell a little bit of a backstory. So a year ago, had you asked me to point to where Keela, Wisconsin is on a map, I'm embarrassed to say I don't think I could do it. It is a sleepy 4,000 person town up in the Manitowoc area. And I fast forward to my brother actually sending me a New York Post article about these kids, these poor kids who, you know, misgendered this kid. And now there's a Title IX investigation. And I, of course, with my media literacy, was like, well, this is clearly not the whole story. And it wasn't the whole story. And I ended up making one of my videos for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on this story because Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty was part of that media campaign that brought national attention to this tiny town and a investigation about children before it was settled that led to bomb threats. And in one of my more prouder moments, in my prouder moments since starting As Goes Wisconsin, Rick Essenberg, president of Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, decided to write an op-ed in response to my TikTok. Ooh. And so I really felt heard in that moment. And then I felt so vindicated because a month or so, maybe a couple months after that, Wisconsin Watch published an investigative, in-depth piece that showed everything that my instincts were on that case was true. And so here to talk about that other background and other situation and even a little bit of a happy ending of what's going on in Keela, Wisconsin now is the reporter of that, Mario Curran, who is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch. And he covers schools and communities of color. And I'm so excited to talk to you because I wrote him an email when he published this. And I said, I don't know if you know me, but thank you for doing this. I feel so vindicated right now. So welcome, Mario.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'll just start with this. Do you think there's anyone who doesn't live in Keela that knows as much about Keela as you do now?
I don't know. I've been following it for close to a year now. So I've had my fill of Keela, that's for sure.
So how did this start for you as a reporter of even getting an inkling of what was happening? Because if I understand, you started hearing things before that national media tour even started, right?
Yeah. So it was about a year ago today. There was an individual from Keela started sending me messages saying, hey, you need to pay attention. We need a reporter here to pay attention to what's going on in Keela. And at first, I thought it was just another sort of culture war story. I thought it would be, you know, your typical story where the community is divided over race or gender. And I wasn't, you know, eager to jump into it. But the more I heard, the more fascinating it became, and the more reason there was for me to get up there. So, yeah, I heard about it slowly, but that tension sort of built over the months and culminated in a series of bomb threats, which, you know, I think we're going to get to. But yeah, my first inkling was just people reaching out to me to get me to pay attention.
And so, and that was in between, because I don't want to screw up the timeline here, because you ended up writing the piece that kind of ended up going back and looking at everything that led to the bomb threats. But even prior to that, you ended up writing a follow-up piece that predated that as far as attacks on critical race theory and the ignoring of a Black student and like the bullying he was under. So it's like there was things that were connected as far as a more conservative group's influence over what was happening in schools. Is that an accurate way to put that?
Yeah. I mean, and that's essentially what attracted me to the story, is that really in Keele, we had this kind of culmination of all these little, I guess, examples of culture wars that were happening across the country. They all seemed to be happening in Keele at the same time. So, for example, on the first day I went up there to just kind of get on the ground and start talking to people, there was a community meeting to talk about the banning or the restriction of public library books, in particular those that were LGBTQ friendly. And sort of the backstory behind there was already tension around CRT and race, like we've seen in a lot of school districts. And finally, we had sort of what pushed it over the edge and really devolved into chaos in the city was tension over pronoun use. Or, there's a lot wrapped into that. But yeah, there was all these issues, sort of a constellation happening right in this very city.
And so with the timeline of what ended up happening, because this is really what it made national news. It obviously was all over Wisconsin. And so the timeline of the Title IX investigation, where things really started to bubble over, can you recap that for us?
Yeah. So like you, Kristen, I grew up in Wisconsin, and that Keele last year was the first time I had heard of Keele. So don't be too embarrassed, because okay. It's not super well known, even in Wisconsin, for a native. But the first time I think most people had heard about it was, as you said, when there was a story about three young boys, middle school boys, being in trouble over for misuse of a pronoun. So to be more specific, there was a student, transgender student, who preferred they, them. The boys had ostensibly or allegedly called her, and so that, as far as everybody else knew, as far as the world knew or the nation knew that was paying attention, that was the story. There was a sort of one-time slip, and these boys were then under investigation for sexual harassment, which sounds pretty, it does sound, I guess, to the average person, that does sound pretty extreme. I mean, one-time slip, and all of a sudden I'm charged with sexual harassment. But, you know, as soon as that story sort of started percolating, that it took off. Libs of TikTok got a hold of it. And as soon as she did, the person that runs Libs of TikTok, death threats started coming in. Yep. Soon after that, there were a series of bomb threats, 6 bomb threats over 9 days that really just sort of paralyzed the city. And in the end, the school district or the school board closed this investigation, ostensibly sexual harassment. And, you know, Will had said, our job is done here. The problem was, there was more to the story, as you pointed out, right? That was the story as far as Will was concerned. So as far as Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, it was a matter of free speech, right? You can't force somebody to use pronouns, and you certainly can't punish them for not doing that. And as far as they're concerned, that's as much as anybody else needs to know. But I think the average person might find it interesting that it wasn't a one-time slip by any means. And in fact, there was tensions that went back weeks and months that we didn't hear about. There was an instance where the three boys had thrown food at the transgender student. So, you know, I didn't argue that whatever happened constituted sexual harassment, that it should be. We didn't know, right? We didn't know the details. I still don't know the details. All I set out to say is that there was more to the story than what was released and what sort of took off on conservative media.
And that was similar to what I said. I mean, I think anyone who knows middle schoolers, my initial reaction as soon as I read this, I was like, oh, this kid's getting bullied. And obviously, that was what ended up being the case, that there was more to the story than a one-time slip-up. And it was with full knowledge that Will was peddling around a certain narrative that led to, in my words, I will use my words, bullying the school district into closing this investigation. And it still gets me fired up. And so, but what's interesting about this is going back to what we said as far as Arnold's case, because there was already a different case of bullying in the school district. And this was about race, where the school didn't really do much there, correct?
Right. So you're referring to the case of Armand Wepner. Armand was, it's not a conservative, it's not a very diverse city racially, right? It's pretty homogenous. Armand was one of five Black students in the high school in 2020. And so there was an instance where, a number of instances where he was subjected to racial bullying, racial slurs. At one point, some text messages came into his phone. His mom saw them and tried to put a stop to it by taking it to the school district. In the end, fast forwarding a little bit through negotiations between her attorney, she was represented by the ACLU and the school district. They had agreed to, okay, let's settle this. Let's provide anti-racism training over a course of weeks and months. And there was a couple of other things that they had agreed to. So that would have been it. However, that sort of agreement to provide anti-racism training really, I guess, got a lot of people fired up in town. So, you know, just so there was a lot of people on, I guess we could say, on the right side of town or the more extreme right side of town that just did not want that to happen, and really kind of made so much noise that the school district stopped pursuing the anti-racism training and just kind of left that on the back burner too. So the point is that there was a separate incident over race that really kind of stirred things up a year prior to what had happened with the bomb threats and pronouns.
Oh, sorry. We're talking to Mario Coran, who is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch, and for the better part, I guess, on the year anniversary today, has been reporting on Keele, Wisconsin, and the different stories, I guess, that you can say that have come out of there, being from the Title IX investigation that led to bomb threats, to, you know, protests against CRT, but to now, it sounds like things are kind of, I don't know if you want to say turning around, but in your most recent piece on Keele, it sounds like there is a part of the population of Keele that doesn't want this kind of small but loud group dictating how much of what's happening in the school district. Could you tell me more about that?
Yeah, that's fair. So, you know, part of what's difficult about the story is really trying to apply accurate political labels here, right? Because this is a pretty moderate school board, all things considered, right? So it's not really far left. It's not incredibly progressive, but they've always been sort of kind of in the middle. So over the past year, what had happened is these kind of further right elements had flipped the school board, taken control of the school board. And as you pointed out, it was a small but vocal minority part of town that had been really made the most noise and been driving this change. But what had happened through the bomb threats, through the CRT backlash, through the efforts to ban books, I think there was a growing, as already sizable, but sort of disorganized part of town that started to pay kind of more attention and said, this is tearing apart the city, and this is not the city that I remember, and started to stand up and organize. And so over the series of more recent months, there was a series of incidents that they said basically enough is enough. And there was an effort to remove the school superintendent, which is something that we've seen happen in other school districts in Wisconsin and across the country. And that effort to remove the superintendent, which was a popular figure, beloved figure in the city of Keele, they didn't let that happen. They stood up and made a lot of noise at a school board meeting and sort of reclaimed that sort of community power. In the end, the superintendent's job was saved. His contract was renewed, and two school board members resigned, one on the spot and one shortly after that community meeting. So in a way, it was sort of the reclamation of this community power that had seen its town hijacked by forces beyond itself.
Absolutely. Well, Mario Caran will still be here when we come back. He is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch. I have some more questions about Keele, but also just kind of the other patterns and trends you're seeing around Wisconsin. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. They don't tell the truth. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We're talking to Mario Caran, who is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch and who has spent the better part of this last year reporting on Keele, Wisconsin, which I think a lot of us hadn't heard of or didn't know prior to last year's Title IX investigation that turned into bomb threats. And so talking about his different reporting, and Jane, you had a question?
I did. Mario, for this group that was trying to get rid of the superintendent and was kind of pushing all of these efforts, do we know whether that was an organically created thing, or are there outside? It just seems like there are outside groups that have been trying to push this kind of activity at school boards across the country. And I'm just wondering if what happened in Keele didn't get a little push from someone from outside.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question and a really important question. And it's one that I set out to answer from the beginning. So it was sort of trying to figure out if in fact it was a truly organic sort of grassroots local movement. I wasn't able to show that there was any sort of coordination with any outside groups, although we do know that we have seen that happen in a couple of instances in Wisconsin. I'm thinking of Wauwatosa, for example, where there was an issue over school board and gender. There was an effort from outside groups that really wasn't grassroots. It was more AstroTurf. They weren't local, but they were sort of pushing this thing. And we've seen that elsewhere. Wasn't able to really show that with Keele, but in some ways it really does matter. That makes it, you know, that turns it into a different element, but in other ways it doesn't really matter, because what we saw in this case was really the proliferation or the use of essentially what are playbooks that are passed off from school district to school district, or maybe not passed between each other, but, you know, one school district in Keele may be using the same sort of playbook that may be used in Manitowoc. And what I mean by playbook are, there are a number of conservative groups. There's a conservative writer named Christopher Rufo, who has really sort of put on paper, this is what we need to do to flip the school board. This is what you need to do if you want to get the school superintendent out. This is basically how you take back control of your school district, to a lot of, and you know, that is marketed to a lot of parents that are interested in parents' rights and might be scared about so-called CRT and the dangers that could bring to it. And so that's, I guess, one element that we do see proliferating and does seem to be a concern across the country, or an issue across the country.
And so, Mario, as far as, obviously you've spent a lot of time focusing on Keele this year, but I'd imagine focusing on education as a reporter at Wisconsin Watch, what are kind of the takeaways that you see as either patterns or trends throughout Wisconsin? Because I think last month we had a parent from the Waukesha School District come in and talk about, you know, certain things happening in the school district here as far as teachers' ability to have to report to parents on kids' behavior at school, whether it comes to using preferred pronouns or coming out of the closet and stuff. And so is this stuff that you're seeing, and is it look the same? And also, do you think there's something to learn from the Kiel residents who, as you said, kind of were a little more disorganized, who finally had had enough, that takeaways from how they came together and did get involved that other communities could repeat?
Yeah, so that was sort of a meaty question, but
sorry.
A couple of sorry. No, there's certainly a lot of patterns to point out. All right, so basically, if we take a step back and we go back a couple of years, we coming out of, or really kind of being in the middle of COVID, we really start to see this sort of hyper involvement of people who are angry, right? They might be angry their kids are out of school. They might be angry their kids have to go back to school wearing a mask. And so we begin to see sort of the involvement of a type of voice, a type of parent that really hasn't been involved, or we haven't really heard that voice as much as we had before. It was angry, right? And so in the past couple of years, that's taken on a couple of different shapes and flavors. One of them being the concern over race, or more accurately, the concern that CRT might be infiltrating their school district. We see this sort of broad concern about wokeness, right? We need to stop the sort of proliferation, this indoctrination of woke teachers. And as part of that, and sort of part of that same sort of bubble, is the fear over pronoun usage and what that might mean for the values to the school district. So there's a lot to be ironed out, and there's a lot of things that people have been mad about. What has happened, at least in Kiel, and then maybe we can think more broadly about it. What has happened, at least in Kiel, is that this stuff sort of hit a fever pitch. That sort of anger was so strong at this local level that it flipped a school board, and it really did stop investigations into bullying. And so what happened over time, though, is that parents in this one local level, in this one local town, I think just became a little bit desensitized to that anger. That anger started to wear on people. People started to notice that some of the claims that were floating around there, some of the misinformation that was driving this anger, wasn't in fact true. So in Kiel, we had a fear over porn at the library. That was one of the claims that was floated in Kiel that made people really mad, but it wasn't true. And so I think what happened in Kiel is that sort of just played out and took its course. And now people are thinking about the future and thinking about what's next and what they want out of a school district. And I think we may start to see that in other school districts. I think parents may start to see, okay, I've had enough, but what do we do? And they might look to a city like Kiel, and they might see how parents in Kiel not only sort of pushed back, but organized to become a political player in a sense, yeah. to become a player that can stop the trends that are happening at the school district level. And so I think that's what Kiel has to offer for parents and other school districts that may want to sort of put a check on the forces that are bubbling up and becoming overwhelming in their school districts.
That's a great answer. And I know coming out of next week's primary, there's going to be a lot more conversations about the different school board races across the state that we're going to do on this show. I don't know if that's something you're going to continue to report on, but thank you for all of your reporting on this, Mario. Like I said, when I first emailed you, the elation I had when I read your article and you getting to exposing the truth when it came to the misinformation that surrounded the story of the Title IX investigation last spring. Thank you for that, because genuinely, I'm sure there's a lot of people in that town who also thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for breaking it down so simply and in such a digestible way. I really appreciate your work on this too, Kristen.
All right. Well, we'll have you back for your next story so we can break that down. But Mario Coran is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch who focuses on education, immigration, and issues affecting communities of color. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that wraps up our noon hour. When we come back, some Valentine's Day candy. Where does it rank on the holiday candy in your book? This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.